Hello, I'm John Coleman from Apostasis, an Institute for the Humanities, an alternative college and high school here on New Milford, Connecticut, USA. Today I'm being joined by Max Egan from the Crow House, and we're going to be talking about Max's background, his work online, broadcasting on different topics in the press, and things related to that. Before we welcome Max and get to know him some, just one announcement concerning Apostasis, and that is, as we're entering the Christmas season here in America, we have various fundraisers coming up to assist the school here, including if you're around Connecticut and Eastern New York, an opportunity for our high schoolers to do your chores in terms of putting up your decorations. And so this is a fundraiser to help us get to an education conference early next year. And you can find out all about that on our website. With that jibber jabber seen to, Max Egan, welcome to A Conversation With.
Nice to be here, brother. Thank you for asking me on. Pleasure to connect with you.
Absolutely. I followed your recordings for a couple of years now, and mostly it's on BitChute, and it's interesting to watch BitChute get a little bit tighter slowly but surely with the algorithms and with their recommendations and so forth. So I've accessed you through that website, and I've benefited greatly from your insights. Would you describe yourself, sir, as a libertarian, or politically speaking, how would you define your outlook?
I would say libertarian, voluntarist, absolutely. That would be me.
And you're in Mexico, in Acapulco, that's correct?
That's correct.
And is that, right now, I'm speaking very much as an outsider to libertarianism and the movement, although I'm familiar with its broad developments over the years. Is Mexico becoming for libertarians something like New Hampshire was 15 or 20 years ago? They used to have this idea of the Free State Project and things. Is that a similar project that's going on down there?
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't respect the government very much in Mexico. I mean, this country was founded on revolution. And a lot of people are kind of seeing that there's a better way than what we've got. And, you know, Mexican is essentially kind of libertarian, in as much as if the politicians push too hard, they get rid of the politicians. they've kind of learned not to respect the government too much here. And the government has learned that they need to respect the wishes of the people. So, yeah, it's a good outlook, and hopefully it will spread to a few more countries, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, here you are, you're in Mexico, and you're broadcasting these lengthy breakdowns of current events and different trends in the world. Mr. Egan, how did you end up doing this? How did you end up covering the different events and with your outlook? If you could speak about the development of your worldview and indeed of your activism, I suppose we could say, reaching out and broadcasting.
Well, it started for me like way back when I was very, very young. When I was 4 years old, I realized something was terribly wrong. When I was 8 years old, I was researching pyramids and things like that and realizing that, you know, history is a lie agreed upon. Mm. And I mean, I never planned on doing what I'm doing. I just kind of fell into this. I mean, as a great quote by someone, I can't remember who, said to you, you don't become a dissenter out of a career choice. You become a dissenter out of the need to dissent against what's happening. I mean, the world's run by criminals, and it's pretty obvious. It's gotten worse and worse over the last 20, 30 years. When the 9/11 attacks happened, I mean, I'd always looked at all this stuff and always been aware of a secret hidden hand, you know, behind the curtain, but never really took it so seriously. It was like a hobby for me to just research this stuff and look outside the box. But when the 9/11 attacks happened, and I thought, well, wow, this is the big event we've been waiting for. They're going to use to usher in their new world order. And you know, they sort of killed 2,997 people live on TV. I thought, well, actually, this is serious. And I need to start talking out about what I know. So I kind of started from there, and it's just sort of propelled me to where I am now. But it wasn't a choice. It wasn't a career choice. It was just, you know, a fact that this needs to be done. This should be addressed. The world needs to wake up and see how we're being manipulated. And so that's what I've kind of focused on in an attempt to help people rediscover themselves, really. You know, I think if people can rediscover themselves and the value of themselves and realize that, you know, these are just our elected officials who are supposed to be actually acting on our behalf, they're doing a god-awful job, they're kind of acting on their behalf instead, then I think that's the solution to the problem. People need to wake up to themselves and realize that we can stop this anytime we want if we just believe in ourselves and unite as a community and are prepared to stand up and call out what we see for what it is.
Great. Thank you for that. And I certainly know, and I think many viewers certainly know, that deep down feeling to act on some conviction and to follow through with that. And then very often, once doing that, to realize how few people are doing that. And you mentioned this early event in your life where you realized things were nonsense. And that's often why I when I consider, you know, my own journey with education and so forth, that's often what I come back to, is this society of drones and this society, which was certainly that conclusion of them being drones, was copper fastened during the COVID-19 shutdowns. Where did this come from? Where do these followers come from? These people that would run horses over old women and all this nonsense that we all went through a couple of years ago, some more roughly than others. Well, it came from partially people at 4 and 5 and 6 and 10 and 15 years of age, probably having similar events to yourself and awakenings, but stifling them because of their training, stifling them because of their indoctrination and conditioning. And that's interesting you mentioned that you pulled the trigger on that early insight, and so many others probably had that same insight and did not.
Well, yeah, fear. I mean, we're kept, we're sent to school, and school is essentially about training you to respect authority more than anything. But don't think outside the box. Just regurgitate what's in the books on command and do what you're told and you'll pass. And I could see a problem with that when I was younger. I mean, they'd be teaching me stuff. And, you know, I spent a lot of time reading encyclopedias from when I was 8 years old. And they'd be teaching me stuff at school. And I'd say, hang on a minute, I've read a book about that. And what you're presenting us with is the most commonly accepted theory. Why aren't we opening these topics up for discussion? I mean, why are you just teaching us that this is the way it is when it very likely isn't, you know? And I ended up being kicked out of four high schools in 3 years, like the high schools. I ended up with my own desk outside the principal's office for my last 6 months of high school because none of the classes would have me. And I just thought, what am I doing here? Why am I participating in this? I just kind of got up and walked out halfway through my end of year exams and became a musician and lived on the outside of society for most of my life and just kind of watched the freak show. Again, until 9/11 happened, you know, music had always been my forte and this research had been a hobby. When 9/11 happened, they switched positions and this became my forte and music became my hobby. And I think a lot of people are just scared to express themselves. You know, they're scared of getting kicked out of school. They're scared of getting in trouble with the teachers and all of that sort of stuff. And I never had that problem. I just would argue with these people no end. And I just think a lot of people are afraid to be themselves. That's what I mean about the rediscovery of the self. I think that's what all this is about. We've lost that knowledge of self. And we judge ourselves by parameters that the society gives us to judge ourselves by, these yardsticks we're taught to measure ourselves by and measure other people by, rather than realizing this is a personal experience. You came here essentially to grow your soul, to grow yourself, you know, to take what you can from this experience, you know, and take that back to source, back to God, whatever happens after we die, you know. But this life, I believe, isn't the be-all and end-all. I think it's what comes after is the most important part. And this life is more of a test, more of an exam than anything else.
Great. Thank you for that. And those are very, very good words to go by. And so often we have at the college here, we have our Fearology Center with Dr. Fisher for the audience, if you're interested in looking into that. And I mean, the whole focus of one of our staff members' research is that, academically speaking, the role that fear plays in history, in different human activities. And it is a massive role. And to buck up against that, and especially, I think, You know, we can say certainly the last 200 years, the whole world, in a sense, is middle class. And there's the whole other aspect of the middle class psychology of, you know, distinctively wanting to fit in. Because if I don't have my job in the middle class, if I'm a peasant somewhere in Mexico or in America or in Canada, a farmer somewhere or a woodsman, I can chop down some trees and build a house, Mr. Egan. I can grow my own food. But in the middle class psychology, you're right. To your point, I'm not gainsaying you at all. I'm just buttressing a certain angle of this fear. In the middle class psychology, there's already the fear that the human being has by nature. But in the middle class psychology, there's also the fact that the social structure is organized in such a way that we have to fit in, or at least we believe we have to, in an extraordinary way. We need our job. We can't have points on our license. We can't have down votes on our business on Google or on Facebook or whatever. There's this doubly oppressive desire to fit in. So very good insights that you offer us about that fearlessness.
Well, yeah, I mean, this whole society is based on fear. I mean, I was lucky that I never really went through that because, like I said, when I left school, I became a musician. So I was kind of working for myself the whole time. Mm-hmm. And when I wasn't doing that, I was making artwork and doing stuff like that, selling it at the markets. I never really had that respect for authority or that belief in authority. Mm. Even as far as, like, you need a license to drive a car, I never bothered to get one. I always figured that it's cheaper to actually pay the fine. if you ever get caught without driving a license, it's cheaper to pay the fine. If you've got a license, they really nail you to the wall. You know, they fine you and they take points off your license and they ban you from driving and all that sort of stuff. So they couldn't really do that to me because I didn't have a license. I always figured it's a lot easier to get forgiveness than permission. I never got a driver's license until I had a son and he turned 18. And he wanted to learn to drive. And I thought, well, shit, I better get a license so that I can legally teach my son to drive. So I got a license at about, like, you know, 45 or 50 years old, my first driver's license. That's just the way I thought. And because I worked for myself in bands the whole time, I didn't have any type of peer group pressure or any of that sort of stuff propelling me into behaving in a certain way. You know, and I, like I said, I mean, I got kicked out of all my schools. If I didn't like the school, I didn't like the teachers, I would just take all the classes off. Like the last school I was in, I spent most of the last half of the year sitting in the library just learning things myself. I'd find out what the topics were in the class, and then I'd go to the library, I'd read books on those topics, and then I'd show up for my exams, and I'd pass the exams. And the teachers used to hate me for it because I hadn't done any classes, and yet I'd pass their tests. So, I mean, that's just the attitude I had. So it kind of carried over with me into my life after I left school. And I never really adopted that fear mentality, but I could see that's what this society is based on. It's all about fear. You can't step outside the lines, can't think outside the box, or you will be penalized. Mm. And I just ignored all that and did my own thing. And it kind of just got me to where I am now. Like I said, this isn't any path I would have chosen, but it needs to be done and someone's got to do it. And I was seeing the truth movement, the so-called truth movement, the resistance, whatever you want to call it, and everybody seemed to have an agenda. And I just thought, I'm just going to speak my mind and encourage people to think for themselves. And I think that is the biggest fear of this government, this control system, is people thinking for themselves. They don't want that at all. So, yeah, I mean, it's just natural process, I think. You know, you live that sort of a life and you end up doing what I'm doing, and it isn't a matter of choice. It's just the way it happens, you know.
It's very insightful about not getting a license, it being cheaper. As someone who's been dinged a few times for not having registration and who just paid $200 for a piece of metal to screw to my car, that actually does sound more economical, actually, to just pay the damn fine and not get the license. Because once you have the license, then they can start punishing the license with fines and with the points and all that jazz. Wowzers, that's quite insightful.
Yeah, well, it gets to a point where you got to do it anyway. Like I said, my son wanted to learn to drive. I thought, well, of course I'm going to have to do this because, you know, it's the choices I made in my life. I'm not going to force him to make those same choices. He can play by if he wants to and find out of his own accord. You know, he's on his own path. So, yes, that's the way I did it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's something I appreciate about your show, The Crow House, and your website is a few years under your belt, and there is a certain moderation and a certain wisdom and life lessons that you have that oftentimes younger commentators don't have. That then there's a certain moderation in particular I've noticed, you know, as opposed to being the young blood, you know, F the system, I'll never get your license and all this. There's a reality. Okay. You have to, your kid has to get a license, whatever you get licensed to, what, why not? There is that. And I think that's often missing in some of the more, strident eddies of the so-called truth movement.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you get penalized in other ways. I mean, you know, I've had my bank account shut down. You know, when I left Australia, they shut down my bank accounts. I've been kicked off pretty well everywhere, like kicked off YouTube or Facebook or Vimeo, like iTunes, iHeart, SoundCloud, MeWe, LinkedIn, like everywhere, you know, it's just crazy. And they've shut down my bank accounts. They've demonetized me everywhere, like closed my PayPals, closed my Subscribestar, my Patreon. Like, they've made it very difficult for me. Mm-hmm. But you still get by. I think a lot of this world is an emotional mirror. And if you start to stress out about stuff, then the universe will give you more of that, where if you just take it in your stride, and it can be inspiring, you know, when you get kicked off all these places and you get demonetized, and you've really got to start thinking of new strategies and thinking for yourself. So it kind of keeps your mind active anyway. There's always a light at the end of the tunnel, and the more I get kicked off their services, the more independent I become. So it's fine by me.
Yes, I was for years doing the footsie with YouTube with different strikes and so forth. And when they finally cashiered the school's channel, after I called NATO a bunch of cannibals, after I think I got on their radar for talking about the American election of 2020 and having hanky panky and nonsense to it. But when the NATO time in Ukraine came around, I was so happy after having been kicked off finally after years of the back and forth with the strikes, Dr. Egan, that I was so happy that I never, you know, how people, you know, they compromise what they say or they use different code words. They do. At least I didn't do that as I was shown the door. And yeah, and there, when anyone on this earth, whether that's online or more importantly in real life, has principles, one of the things you learn, as they say, on the high moral ground is you have a lot of elbow room on the high moral ground, and there aren't a lot of people doing that.
Well, yeah, and they don't like it. I mean, I've been kicked off all those platforms, and you'll find that if you post this video on YouTube, it will probably get deleted within a day. Some people, even if I live stream on YouTube, they'll shut the stream down halfway through. I think they've got algorithms that actually recognize my voice, and they won't reinstate me. And anybody who has me on generally gets a strike against their channel or whatever. So, but I never monetized. I never became dependent upon it. I warned them, monetized YouTube. I said, this is a trap. You're going to start thinking of yourself as an entrepreneur. You're going to start sensationalizing your headlines. It's going to be more about clicks than bringing awareness and wakefulness to the world. Have traffic so you get monetized, and then you're gonna forego all of your real world stuff that you used to do and how you used to make a living. You're going to become dependent upon YouTube, and then when you say something to your wife, they're going to shut you down, and you're going to have severed all your connections in the real world, and you're going to be stuck between a rock and a hard place. So I never monetized. I never became dependent upon it, and I think a lot of people into that trap. You know, I started thinking, you know, the banking system and the monetization of everything is what we're speaking out against in the resistance. And here are you people becoming dependent upon it, starting to think of yourself as being I'm a reporter now, you know, and it's not really what it's supposed to be about. And this is a trap. And I did warn people about it, and then it just happened like clockwork, you know.
That reminds me of maybe 20 years ago here in America and in the New England, we say, or the Northeast more recently. There were these doulas, these home birth women mostly. And they 20 years ago, Mr. Egan, 20 years ago, these doulas swore up and down they would never be part of the system. They would never be part of the John Rockefeller medicine. We'll never go in for them. They're all devils and they're all sorts of agendas. And then somewhere along the line in the last 20 years, all the doulas got registered and licensed, and they're as you know, they're as happy as a pig in mud to be part of the system. And I've seen the exact same phenomena, you say, with some of these truth people or these patriots or whatever you call them. It is a dangerous, it is dangerous to belly up to power, including YouTube. But with all that being
said,
yes, sir.
Well, I forget why we started doing this. It was to speak out against all that, to speak out against having to register everything. I mean, registration, when you look at it, where it all leads back to, I mean, you're basically giving the state control of every aspect of your life. Same when you register your children, birth certificates, all that sort of stuff. You're giving them complete control of your lives, and that's always been the problem. Mm-hmm. So yeah, as an activist and as someone speaking out against the system, I don't want anything the system has to offer me. I just, mm-hmm. I don't want it. I don't care about it. I don't need it. It's not why I'm here. I'm here, like I said, to grow my own soul. And mm-hmm. I'm 67 years old now, 68 soon. And, you know, I've lived on the outside of the system my whole life. I've never filled out a tax form. I've never owned a credit card. I've never done any of that stuff. I mean, I've never owned a credit card, so I'm 67 and I have no debt. I mean, mm-hmm. but I don't want for a lot of stuff either, but I don't need a lot of stuff, you know. People believe, you know, life is about, you know, grabbing as much money as you can and buying as many things as you can. And at the end of life, the one with the most wins. Mm. Yeah, and I've always looked at things a different way. And I think there's too many people falling into that trap. Now, we're at a time of enormous opportunity right now. I mean, the system is being laid bare, the apocalypse, the lifting of the veil, the great revealing. Mm. It's happening. Everyone can see the corruption for what it is. So, you know, it's their conscious choice now as to whether you want to swim in that corruption or whether you want to be some spark of freedom that might inspire the rest of humanity to get out of this control grid that we're currently in. Because, you know, if we don't change the direction we're going, unfortunately, we're going to go where we're headed. And that's not a very good place. So, and it comes down to us. It ultimately comes down to us, our belief in authority, our willingness to comply with behavior that we know is wrong, our willingness to step outside our moral compass in order to abide by legislation. You know, it's wrong. It's completely wrong. And I think now's the time we have to make a stand. But too many people fall into that trap. And that was what I was seeing that was wrong with the so-called truth movement. It wasn't about the truth. It was about people arguing over their belief systems and people's need to be right, you know. And I think it should more rightly be called the freedom movement. Let's establish the freedom to find out what the real truth is instead of arguing about all this stuff, because that division that those arguments create is the very thing that prevents us ever establishing the freedom we need to put all the questions down. Realize that all these questions you ask and all these rabbit holes you're going down, they only exist because you're kept under control. You're not given the information that you need. So let's address that. I mean, it's just a different way of looking at things. But for me, that's the core issue that we need to focus on.
Mm. Yes, as one previous guest on this series, Clint Richardson, mentioned another man who was very much moved by 9/11, and that altered the trajectory of his life as well as yours. So a number of other people watching this, no doubt. As Clint Richardson said, you know, the truth movement that no one can agree on the truth, and a truth movement that never moves anywhere because it's arguing, like you say. All it does
is... I've often said that the real truth is that no one knows what the real truth is, and that's the real truth that no one's prepared to admit. And in order to find out what the real truth is, we need to establish the freedom to be able to find out. So let's turn it into the freedom movement, you know?
So I'd like to get your insights into one of the most pressing events at present, and that is the massacre, the genocide in Gaza, which you have given such attention to. Before we jump on that, Mr. Egan, I must ask, what is the Crow House? What is the... what is the thinking behind that name? Why the Crow House as your name of your website?
Well, that's a really strange story, actually. Like, I was separated from my son. My wife and I were divorced. I was separated from my son. And the only way I could actually play with him for a while was that we used to meet on a game server and play an old game called Enemy Territory. And my name in the game was Scarecrow. He named me Scarecrow. And I actually ended up doing a lot of artwork for the game server, And people used to just call me Crow, blah, blah, blah. And one guy offered, well, you need to open up a website to put all your artwork on. So it became the Crow House. And then I felt guilty that I had this website and didn't have any truth on there or any sort of spiritual stuff on there. It was all about game stuff. And I thought, I can't do it. I've got to start posting what I know on this website. And it just became a truth portal. And then Crows started following me around everywhere. Like, crows kind of became my totem, really, not through any choice of mine. They just started appearing in my life and following me around. Like, I'd be out in the middle of nowhere driving across Australia, get to a fork in the road, not know which way to go because there's no signpost. But there'd be a crow there on the tree. And I'd go, oh, I'll go that way. And it was always the right way. Things like that. So it just kind of happened. It was just this organic thing that happened. Wasn't any real intention behind it. Then I started looking into crows and crow medicine and crow magic, and I thought, well, this actually is everything that I do in my life, which is remarkable that they chose me as my totem. And it was just an unrelated thing, but that's what it is.
Great. Thank you for that insight there. I will remember that next time I go to the website and check out your stuff on BitChute, as the audience certainly will as well.
BitChute's about the only site that I can still post on now. I mean, they've done really well keeping free speech going on BitChute. So absolute respect for Ray and the guy who runs it. They've tried everything they can to get around local laws and legislation and to keep the message out there. It's one of the few free speech platforms we've got left.
Yeah, I mean, the people on BitChute are often cranky, the commentators. I don't think they've had a productive one in all these years, but... As I turn off all the comments, you're going to get, who knows, you're going to get Nazi stuff or X, Y, and Z. I say, you know, whatever.
I get a lot of trolls. Like Ray tells me I'm the most trolled channel on all of BitChute, and they want you to turn off the comments because that's how we communicate. It's a lot of good stuff in the comments, but there's a lot of bots, there's a lot of insults. And I just refuse. I'm not going to turn off. The more you push me and troll me and want me to turn off the comments, the louder I'm going to speak, and I'm going to leave the comments on. So, I just don't do authority very well. I don't follow orders very well.
Nice. Well, I will have to consider that. I certainly will not turn off the comments on this video with that background. I must consider it across the board.
Yeah, well, you'll get lots of trolls just for having me on. I'm sure they'll come see you. And I get all sorts of accusations, and also it's quite comical, really. But it's also inspiring. I mean, if you've got to troll me this much, well, obviously I'm making a difference. Obviously I'm reaching more people than you want me to. If you're going to put this much work into trying to shut me down and discourage me, then I must be definitely on the right track. So in many ways, I find it inspiring.
Well, trolls are a headache, but more seriously, as we look across the world scene, there are many points of crisis, and one of the sternest and starkest is Gaza, and you have given a great deal of attention to this genocide. So what, Mr. Egan, has been your interaction with Gaza personally and your interest in these people, ultimately, and this story?
I actually went to Gaza Strip in 2012. I was with someone in England and they'd actually been into Gaza before, and I thought they might be able to help me get in there. And I said to him, let's go to Gaza. He said, what do you want to go to Gaza for? And I said, well, you got the key to the city. You know, how often am I going to be this close to Gaza with someone who might be able to get in? You know, he said, what do you mean close to Gaza? We're in London, you know? I said, well, hey, man, I'm from Australia, you know? Like, we're only 4 hours flight from Cairo in London. I live in Australia. It takes me 5.5 hours to fly from Brisbane to Perth, for God's sake. So, yeah, we're close, And we ended up getting in there. We snuck in through a rebel tunnel. Hamas didn't know we were coming. Nobody knew we were coming. And I spent 10 days in there running around with the video camera. I met a lot of people. We ended up getting detained by Hamas as we were trying to leave, and they were very understanding. They interrogated us for 5 hours to try to find out how we got in, threatened us with a firing squad, but was kind of tongue-in-cheek. They were giving us tea and biscuits, and they were fine with me. I actually provided a driver to get me back to Cairo safely, sent my lost luggage after me. Didn't come across like a terrorist organization. But I met a lot of really real people in there. And what I found was a world of children. I mean, the average age in Gaza Strip is 17 years old, was back in 2012. Now 75% of the population of Gaza are 17 years old or under. This isn't a war that Israel is waging against these people. It's a genocide. It takes two armies to have a war. This isn't a war. And after going in and meeting these people and breaking bread with these people, I found some of the most kindest, most humble, down-to-earth people I'd ever met in the Gaza Strip. And I've often said to people, like, I became a full-blown activist for a few years and focused on Gaza from like 2012 to probably 2015, 2016. I put a lot of focus on it, condemning Israel for what it's doing, for holding these people under siege. And then I started to realize that it's not, you can't focus on Israel. That's not going to be the way out of it. You've got to understand that it's our Western politicians that are funding Israel and enabling them to do this. So we need to put the focus on our own governments. These governments are committing war crimes by simply supporting a state which is carrying out war crimes. I mean, the very existence of Gaza Strip is collective punishment, which is a breach of Article 32 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. It's a war crime, you know, just the fact that it exists. And if our governments are supporting it, then what do you think they have in store for us? And I've often said Gaza is the greatest moral dilemma we face in the world today. And if we don't reach within our hearts enough to deal with this dilemma and realize these are people, doesn't matter whether they're Muslims or Christians or whatever, they're people. If we cannot deal with this, then the way of Palestine will be the way of the world. A lot of people don't realize that there's hundreds of thousands of Christians in Palestine as well. Most 35% Christian, I don't know what it is now, they probably killed most of them. But it's a huge moral dilemma. And it's being supported by all Western politicians. If they're going to do that in Gaza Strip, and it's a form of warehousing and surplusing human beings. And all of our police have been going to Israel to train. That's why they've gotten so brutal these days. You know, like all wearing body armor, and they throw you to the ground and put their knees on your neck and stuff like this. I mean, these are all Israeli soldiers' tactics. And it's coming to all of our countries if we don't deal with it. And now they're carrying out an open genocide. I mean, people have got to call this out for what it is. And I've always seen it as one of the more important issues in the world. And, I mean, there's so many issues that we've got. We've got migrant immigration into Europe, into all Western countries, which is all being run by the same people. But these people that are running Gaza, if you really start looking at some of the most heinous crimes that ever happened in the United States, the assassination of a president, John F. Kennedy, the 9/11 attacks, these people, their fingerprints are on all of it. So, you know, they're prepared to do this in front of the world and test our moral fiber. Really, I mean, if you're not speaking out about it, if you're just allowing this to happen, then you're part of the problem, unfortunately. And that's just the way I looked at it. So, I mean, I've put a lot of focus on there because I've been there and I've met the people. I know the people. It's like if I had family anywhere, if like I've really good friends in Croatia, if they were being genocided, I would be focused on that as well because they're my friends. I know these people. I've been there and spent time with them. And I can't just sit idly by and watch this happen. So, I speak out about it because, and also they need a voice. Yeah, and the world needs to witness what's going on here. And I'm making sure that they do witness it and do see it because this is going to maybe plague their conscience or something, but they're going to realize that this is happening because of our inaction, our toleration of wrong behavior. We're allowing our politicians to act completely outside the parameters of anything we can screw as good or moral or just or wholesome. And we're just allowing it to happen. Oh, just give me my TV and my racing cars on a Saturday and your football games and I'm good, you know. Well, it's got to come beyond that. We've got to see this moral dilemma that we are facing because this gives us an opportunity to heal.
Yes, you know, as just a personal insight, when I was a little bit younger, I was a line cook and a dishwasher at a bar, and this was during Iron Dome, the Israelis, so-called, they were attacking, if it wasn't Gaza, it was Lebanon or it was West Bank. It was Iron Dome. That was the name of the military operation. And I remember very, very well coming out of the kitchen and looking at a dining room in America here in Connecticut. And it was dinner time, Mr. Egan, and everyone was eating. They were stuffing their faces and on all the TVs around was this Iron Dome. I believe it was Gaza where they were knocking the stuffing out of. And the people had no connection. There were people dying on the TV in front of them, and they were just stuffing their faces with chicken wings and hamburgers. The seared conscience, the seared consciousness of these people was amazing. And we need more people talking about this. And yet, the obliviousness continues. I mean, people are, they're like intoxicated when you, they have no idea in this, in America, at least they have no idea about some of these stories that are going on with Gaza, with Ukraine and all of this stuff. It's amazing. The obliviousness.
Well, yeah, I mean, they just think Gaza is a Muslim terrorist enclave, and it's not. It's not. It's collective punishment. And like I said, it's a world of children, and 35% Christian as well. And yeah, people are, they're oblivious to it. They've even got an observation deck. I was listening to an interview with someone the other day, a soldier who went to Israel, and they took him to an observation deck where he's basically overlooking the genocide, and they're seeing how the land's being cleared, and they're picking out where they want to put their new homes. There's actually boat rides that go out from Israel into the ocean. They take families out on boat rides at night to watch the bombings, and they're all cheering it on and high-fiving each other. And it's crazy. This is people being slaughtered live in front of the world, and the world is completely oblivious. I mean, America, of course, is an adolescent culture. I mean, from an outsider, when I look at the United States, it's like an adolescent, it's like a big frat house, the whole place. It's a very adolescent type of culture. And Americans are beautiful people. Most of them are kind people. They're good people. But they're completely oblivious to anything that the television hasn't educated them on, you know, which is not education. So that's an unfortunate reality. And I think it's going to take until it actually comes to their backyard before they're prepared to stand up and say anything about it. But that's the important thing, is that it is coming to their backyard. The way of Palestine will be the way of the world. And I just hope that they wake up to that before it's too late to stop it, you know?
The last question I have, and we should hope to have you on in the future on this series, Mr. Egan, but the last question concerning Gaza that I have is somewhat speculative. And there are two lines of thought. There are many lines of thought, but I propose two to you, and maybe you have something else you want to add beyond these. One is that the war in Gaza and in Lebanon, and with where they're trying to have a war in Iran, or at least get America to fight that war, the motivation for that is to create such chaos in Israel that the Ashkenazi Jews will move to Ukraine, and they will make Ukraine the new Israel. And there are certain stories in the Middle East they write about this. I have certain stories in English even that write about this among some of the crazy Zionists. That is their option. And then the other is, you know, this is just a naked power grab. This is a fight to the knife. They're going to drive the Arabs out, and this is the final showdown at the OK Corral, at least to knock out Gaza, and then the West Bank will be next. Those are the two scenarios I proposed to you. Maybe there's a third. What do you think? What the hell is going on? What is the end game of the present violence?
Well, all of the above that you just said. Always, they also want to create greater Israel in that region.
Oh, no.
That's why they're attacking Lebanon, why they're bombing Syria. If you look at the map for greater Israel, this is what they want to do. They want to take over from bits of Iraq as far as the Euphrates. They want all of Syria. They want all of Jordan. They want all of Lebanon. They want southern Turkey. They want the top of all of the Sinai. They want the top of Saudi Arabia, and they want part of Egypt, everything east of the Nile. They want to be part of greater Israel. So this is a cover for that as well. But one of their main goals, they talked, like, even when you look at the birth of Zionism and Theodore Herzl and all these people, they talked about the third great war, which will be the war of Christians against Muslims. Mm-hmm. They want the Christians and Muslims to wipe each other out, kill as many of you people as possible, so then we can just go in and mop up the rest. That's the plan. The Mossad motto, by way of deception, we shall do war. This is what they want to do. They want to create as much instability as possible. They definitely want to get rid of Iran, and they're getting America to do that. I mean, every war the United States has fought in the last 40 or 50 years have been proxy wars for Israel. It's just going in and wiping out Israel's enemies, because the American government is completely infested by dual Israeli citizens. I mean, it's ridiculous. Even Trump coming to power now, he's surrounded himself with hardcore right-wing extremist Zionists, all of them, you know, and it's unfortunate to see, but that's the plan. I mean, they want East and West to wipe each other out. Look at the Kalugi plan. They want to replace the white races all around the world, just merge them all together into one race, Goyim, so they can rule. They want the UN gone. They want a new UN with Israel at the top. they're creating all this, like they want the world to hate them as well, because it says in their Bible, it says in their end times, that at the end times, the world will all turn against Israel. They want it unsafe for Jews in Europe, so they've all got to come back to Israel or go to Ukraine. Zelensky's a Jew. There's been something like 140,000 Israelis moved to Ukraine in the last 12 months. While the Ukrainians are being depopulated and wiped out and sent to the front to die, you've got all these Israelis moving in there. None of them are going fighting in the war. You know, you find that none of them fight in the US wars either. You know, so very, very low percentage of these people in the military forces, unless it's the IDF. And the IDF itself was formed out of three terrorist organizations that were named as terrorist organizations back in the 30s. Irgun, Haganah, and the Stern Gang all merged to become the Israeli Defense Force, which isn't defending anything. But it's about reshaping the world and setting up Jerusalem as the world capital, and creating this animosity, creating this hatred, you know, polarization of the world. A lot of people support Israel. A lot of people don't support Israel. You can find out where they all are, isolate those people, and take the world where they want it to go. So, and they're using the United States to do it. The United States is essentially the attack dog of Israel at the moment. It's little more than a vassal state of Israel at the moment. And the United States has been milked dry. Look at the amount of poverty. Look at what's going on in the streets of Philadelphia. And go and look at Tel Aviv. Look at Israel. Look at how vibrant and modern and how much funding they've got. And you know, everything's great in these countries, but the United States is just being completely milked dry. And it's important that people see this. I mean, it's the big end game that they want, to put themselves in control of the world, establish greater Israel, establish a bastion in Ukraine as well, because, of course, they want to crash the US dollar, wanting to bring in a new trade system, you know, BRICS, all this sort of stuff. And you've got the Chinese with the One Belt, One Road trade system they want to put in place. Ukraine is an integral part of that. So they want to control that. And, of course, they want to control Israel as well, because then they've got control of the Suez Canal. They want to build a new Ben-Gurion Canal. They get to control all world trade and get to control all world affairs by controlling those two states, Israel, Greater Israel, and Ukraine. And that's where it's all going, and it's becoming pretty obvious to people.
Indeed, indeed. So, Max Egan, thank you very much for your insights. I very much would like to have you back on in a few months and touch on some of these topics, whether that's BRICS, the war in Ukraine, Gaza, I'm afraid will not be going anywhere soon. Hopefully in a also in a positive way in the long run, that they will not be broken. Certainly, they're not indicating that they shall be. And certainly the American situation with the recent vote and so forth. But for right now, people can find you on the Crow House here and on BitChute. Both of those links are down below in the description. Is there anywhere else people ought to check out concerning your work?
Well, you'll find me on Odyssey, you'll find me on BitChute, you'll find me on Rumble, but the best place is probably BitChute. And thanks for having me on, John. It's been a pleasure to connect with you, and we'll definitely do it again anytime.
Great. So to the audience, thank you for your attention. Please do check out Mr. Egan's sites there. And indeed, Max Egan, thank you so much for your insights.
My pleasure.